Hello, there we are. Hey, good to be with you guys today. My name is Jeff Bradford. I'm one of the founding pastors of the Liberty Network, and I have six sons, which means that if my church tanks, my family name keeps going. So I got you all, I think, unless anybody can beat me in that, I got you all hands down. My legacy keeps going. I'm assigned with talking about the topic today, Now What?, which is everything post-launch. And I want to tell you a story to begin with. A little echoey here. When my wife and I had just coming home from the hospital with our first son, we are, you know, the elated parents who are exhausted. We hadn't slept in several nights in a row. And it's the middle of the summer. And if you can imagine, middle of Philly summer, as you know, is ridiculously hot. We go to the mall. And this is the Neshaminy Mall. We're in the parking lot, and we get out. We're going to take the photos in to get them developed. This is before digital cameras. That's how old I am. And we both get out of the car. I leave the car running. The air conditioning's on, and we lock ourselves out of our car. And we're standing there staring at each other, freaking out. Like, the baby's asleep in the back seat. The car's running. The AC's on. We don't have any other keys. We don't know anybody around. We didn't know anybody in this area. And we're just both, like, exhausted. My wife starts bawling. I'm like, what the heck? You know, I just overwhelmed parents. And we finally have to get the security guard from the mall to come and break the window. The baby still doesn't even wake up. You know, we get in the car, we go home. But, you know, it's so parallel to where many of us find ourselves post-launch in church planting. It's like, wait a second. Somebody gave me keys to the car and a little baby congregation. For real. They're going to trust me with this? It's kind of a, you know, it's a kind of a joke. Like, becoming a father, most men are not even anywhere near prepared for this. In the same way, most of us have, you know, as we get into church planting, thinking about what comes next is really, really a surprise. For real? They're going to give me a baby and keys? You know, I want to give you two words in terms of, by way of introduction before we go in. First is, remember that I'm a conference speaker. When you hear a conference speaker, you should always be saying, there is another side to the story. You know, of course I'm going to tell you about good decisions, you know, some of our victories, some of the great things that happened with our team and our successes. But let me, you know, tell you, I am not going to give you, like, the top keys to, like, successful church planting. I want to remind you before anything else, the one thing that you know and you better stinking remember after I'm done talking today, which is that Jesus is the Lord of his church. He is the one who provides for it. Of course, you guys know this. We all talk about this. Jesus is the one who makes it increase. Jesus is the one who provides gifts for church. But I want you to remember this above everything else. Jesus is, if there's any X factor in the success of our churches, Liberty Movement, if there's any success, any X factor, it's not because of strategies and programming. It's because of Jesus. You know, It was not like we just had some potholes as we were driving along the way. It's as if we're driving on a road with sheer 1,000-foot cliffs on either side, and Jesus is holding onto the wheel while I'm messing with the radio. He is the one who, in spite of all of the dumb things that we ever thought about doing or mistakes, or, you know, he is the one who provides for his church. Remember that. That's one of the main things I want you to remember. The second is that I want to focus our time today on a particular part of church life. You know, I assume if you're here at an Acts 29 gathering that we all have some similar visions for what it means to call a church a church. So when I'm looking at from everything after the launch of the first service to the point where the church is established for mission, meaning that it is self-supporting. It's got three selves. Self-supporting financially, self-governing with elders, and a plan for self-propagation. We're not just building ministry cul-de-sacs. We're building ministries and churches that are going to continue to plant themselves. So this is my goal, from post-launch of the first service to the point where the place is organized for mission. Self-supporting, self-governing, self-propagating. That's how we measure success of what a church plant is, right? Acts 29 people, you should be nodding. You should be saying, yeah, buddy, that's right. That's what we're going for. So let me give you my outline for today. Where are we going today? These five things: managing your time and yourself, managing your heart expectations, not managing your church, managing to find good partners, and managing to actually have fun doing ministry. That's where I'm going today. Before I jump in, I want to give some props to Steve Huber. We partnered in starting the Liberty Movement. To Glenn McDowell, who was my coach starting out. To the elders at Liberty Church, who basically kept me from doing something more stupid than I already did in ministry. So let me jump in. Managing your time and yourself. You know, it's striking to me when we look at what are the callings of a pastor and overseer. One of the things we see in the scriptures is from 1 Timothy 4. You know, 1 Timothy 4, Paul is writing the exhortation to young Timothy, and he tells him this in 1 Timothy 4:16. Keep a close watch on you, on yourself. Because, you know what, the greatest enemy, one of your greatest enemies and barriers and obstacles in ministry is you. You know, yourself. You are your own worst enemy. And so I want to think with you, what does it mean to manage yourself? And first I want to talk to you about scheduling. You know, there's a lot of us are used to being, you know, we've done jobs where we've had to clock in. We've had to report to somebody. There was a job description with expectations about how you would spend your time. And one of the challenges of jumping into church planting that many of you have discovered is that there's no clock. There's no grid that says, here's what you got to do this time. Here's what you got to do this time. Here's the expectations. Here's your schedule for the week. You have to come up with that yourself. It's one of the great challenges. And I think that honestly, there's a lot of ways that we sin with our calendars. Let me name a couple of these for you and see, you know, we don't just do this in one way. We do this in several ways. So first is procrastination. You know, putting off things that we don't want to do. Perhaps you've heard of Parkinson's Law, not to be confused with Parkinson's disease. Parkinson's Law says work will expand to fill up whatever time I have for it. Have you noticed that before? You've got, you know, a couple of days to write a sermon, and somehow it's like, you know, you're cramming it in the last couple of minutes. You know, work expands to the amount of time allotted. Parkinson's Law. You know, some other sins with our calendars. Drivenness, the sense that I can do it all, I should do it all, I better do it all, everybody expects me to do it all. An ungodly drivenness with a sense of like, you know, I've got to make these things happen, it's all up to me. And this sense of drive, 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 fill every minute. Third, laziness. You know, I know I'm naming your junk maybe, but all of us have a certain level of laziness, you know, where maybe it's because we're overwhelmed, maybe because the demands are much higher than things we're prepared for, but there is a certain level of laziness with open time that creeps in. And finally, you know, a responsiveness to everybody else's expectations. It is easy to feel in ministry, don't you feel this? That you have like 1,000 bosses. Everyone's expectations can become your job description. Hey, you've got to do this. You're supposed to be my chaplain. You're supposed to be my buddy. You know, it's easy to allow other people's expectations to define us. You know, I actually preached this past Sunday on this passage from Ephesians chapter 5. I would encourage you to meditate on this, brothers. Ephesians chapter 5, verses 14 through 16 tells us this. Wake up, O sleeper, arise from the dead, and Christ will shine on you. Look carefully then how you walk, not as unwise but wise, making the best use of the time, because the days are evil. You know, the word there for time is, the word there for making use of the time is actually the word redeem. an older translation says, redeeming the time, allowing the resurrection of Jesus to touch your calendar life, allowing the gospel to speak into those heart issues. Why do I procrastinate? Why am I driven? Why do I tend to be lazy? In the Bible, the word time is used. There are two different words that are used. The word chronos, which means chronology, hours, minutes, seconds, days, and kairos, which is the word for season or opportunity. And in this passage, Paul says, hey, make the best use of the kairos. Allow God's chosen opportunities, his calling, to determine what your chronos looks like. Allowing Jesus' priorities for you. He's the one you're responsible to. He's your boss, not those 1,000 other people and their expectations. Allowing that to so order your schedule. Look, so I know that we approach time in different ways. Some of us approach it like a bottle that we can fill up and then we pour out. Some of us approach it like cash that we can spend. But we all send with our calendar. So let me make this really concrete for you. I am not really smart. I have to really think about my schedule. This is what my schedule looks like. Maybe it'll be helpful for you, maybe not. So this is my week. I think of my week in blocks. And it helps me to at least keep on the calendar stuff that I know I need to do. So Mondays, I don't work. That is my Sabbath day. I try not to ever look at my phone, take phone calls, or look at my email on Mondays. Tuesdays, I work on the ministry. That means that I'm thinking structurally about bigger picture stuff. It helps to put that early in the week because that's one of the things that will always get squeezed out. So that's when I plan a sermon series. I might look ahead to like what is some leadership development that we need to do in a church. What are some things that, you know, honestly are incredibly important things but are not urgent? So I spend Tuesday doing this. Wednesday, work with. I invest in the people that are alongside me. Staff people, elders. I try to plan important meetings with people that are responsible to me on Wednesdays. Thursdays are my study days. So I'm looking ahead not only what's coming up that week, but the week beyond that. Spend all day Thursday studying. No appointments on Thursdays. Friday is sort of a catch-all work in. I'm using the distinction between working on the ministry, working in the ministry. I do a lot of meetings with unbelievers, with people in the church that just want to, hey, I need to meet with the pastor. That's Fridays. Saturday, I try to spend as much as I can in family days. My kids are off school that day. And Sundays are overworked days. Everybody knows that. Sundays are overworked days. That's how I look at my schedule. You may not need something like that. I try to guard my dinner times. I try to guard my time at home with my family over a meal. I encourage you, brothers, if you have small children, to make that time over dinner sacred. You don't have to do ministry during that. God has given you a schedule to fill up. You know, a schedule that you can use in a way that honors him. And I really urge you to think critically in the phase of ministry from launch to organization for continuing ministry to really think about how you're going to manage your time. Second, do the small things every day. Do the small things every day. Let's be honest. Most pastors want some kind of big explosion to happen early on in the life of their ministry that's going to take them over the edge. Right? They're looking for like the killer mower event. Yeah, the killer like event that's going to happen. You know, the like sermon series that changes it all. And does that happen? It sometimes happens, but what I think is actually more significant, and let me look back to a sports analogy for this. You know, most teams don't win, you know, games in the postseason on one Hail Mary pass. They win it on little 4-yard gains, 8-yard gains, 11-yard gains, little bits. You know, the little bitty victories are what build the large victory. You know, and look, I think this is really important for us thinking about our ministries. You know, God has called us not for like, hey, I'm going to give you the one explosive thing that's going to, you know, it's going to all, the lid's going to come off. I think that God has called us to ministry of faithfulness in small things that actually are part of the little 4-yard advance, the little 8-yard advance. Things like this. returning your phone calls and emails within a pretty prompt amount of time. You know, showing up on time to stuff. Praying regularly. Loving and serving people. Studying hard, preaching passionately. Having a consistent and strong work ethic. Following through on commitments. You know, you can hope that God's going to give you that one, like, explosive thing. Most guys who are successful in planting a church and not just having a church gathered, but a church organized for ministry, are successful in this one area. Following through on the small things. Second, managing your heart and your expectations. This is the hardest thing for me. This is why I put it early in the presentation. As I said, this is not like top 10 secrets for church success. This is one of the things that takes a lot of guys out. And so I need to speak to you as a pastor and a brother who has struggled. I'm going to speak to you out of some of my struggles. Expecting and dealing with key desertions. You know, there are people who will come with you. There are people who will move in to the neighborhood with you, who you will call your best friends, who you think of as like, man, this person's with me. And they will move out of town with your heart in the back of their car. You know, there are people who will leave for a variety of reasons. They'll say, man, your vision stinks. Really? I mean, there are people who will not think that your vision was all that amazing. There are people who will say, you know, your vision's too hard. Or your vision's not my vision. You know, this is very, very real for us. And the big question for you, the big question for me is, are you going to call those people my people or Jesus' people? Are you going to call those people my people or are you going to call them Jesus' people? If you call them Jesus' people, you will recognize that maybe he's calling them somewhere else. Maybe he's calling them somewhere else to be a part of a better vision that they're more suited to than yours. Maybe he's calling them somewhere else because they're going to blow up in their marriage a year from now and he doesn't want to take down your church. Maybe Jesus is taking care of you by removing this person from your midst. That's actually called a Scottish revival meeting when God takes away people and the church grows. You know, are you going to manage your heart expectations by taking that back to the cross? Jesus, these are your sheep. These are your people. They are not mine. You know, I joke sometimes, and this is showing you my dark underbelly. But I sometimes joke that, you know, I'm a character in Tim LaHaye's Left Behind. All the people who have left me behind, you know, in my moments of darkness and self-pity. But do we believe? Can we trust God, the one who provides for the church, that he provides the key people that we need to be able to do ministry? And that if they are removed, people that you thought were key people, that maybe God's saying, you don't need what you think you need to do what I've called you to do. Can we trust Jesus with his gifts? Next, this isn't the church I plan to pastor. I got some bad news for you. I got some bad news. What happens when you look around 2 or 3 years into the work and you're like, man, this is not what I planned on. I am not. This isn't the dream team. This is the island of the misfit toys. This is the bad news bears. You know, when you look around the church and you say, this is so lame. I would not want my friends from Bible college or seminary to ever, ever visit my church. You know, I feel your pain. I remember looking around a small group about 2 years in, and we've got the one guy who's got Tourette's and is having like dreams about headless ducks and speaking in Latin. And I've got, you know, like homeless guys who are talking to themselves. And I've got other people who are like squeaky clean church people. And I'm like, this is not what I planned on. I did not sign up for this one, Jesus. You know, look, my pride, your pride is too easily bound up in our churches, isn't it? You know, isn't it hard to like wrestle yourself out of this? It reflects on me.
Hey, Jesus, you're making me look bad here.
You know, how do you think that the Son of God feels about his church? As much as we would say, man, this is lame. These people are lame. What do we read in Hebrews 2? That Jesus is not ashamed to call us his brothers? as lame and raggedy as our churches can sometimes look and feel to us, the Son of God is not ashamed to call us his brothers. He is not ashamed of his church. And therefore, are we going to follow him in serving in love, or are we going to hold up this like, this isn't what I signed up for? You know, my temptation, I'm really taking off, you know, all the clothes here. You know, my temptation in moments of darkness and of self-pity is to look at church porn. You know, I'll get on the internet, I'm looking at church jobs and other places. I'm like, man, the bride of Christ looks really sexy in that part of the world. I think Jesus is calling me there. I really think my gifts would be well used and appreciated there. You know, church porn, man. My version of the bride of Christ, she's not looking so good. She's kind of fat. She's kind of ugly. She sure is dumpy. And I need to find a better, sexier model. Don't we feel that way? You know, look, are you going to follow Jesus' call to Peter? John 21. I think, you know, Jesus knew exactly who he was talking to with Peter when he says, hey, Peter, feed my sheep. No, really, I mean it. Feed my sheep. Now, let me tell you one more time to make sure that you've got it. Feed my sheep. You know, what helps me with this is marriage, having kids. Some of you, you know, who are married, this really comes down to the day in and day out of what it means to be married to your wife or your husband over the long period. Am I going to love the idealized wife, or am I going to love and serve the real thing? Am I going to love and serve the idealized kids or the ones that are driving me crazy? You know, God gives us marriage. He gives us children. And it is part of his cleansing work to prepare his sons to be pastors in the church. And I want to urge you, you know, to say, I've got to die to this. I die to the idealized bride of Christ, and I've got to serve and love the real one. You know, man, the church is full of sinners. And guess what? We live in a broken world. Don't know if you knew that. Don't know if you remembered that we're in a church full of sinners. And we're in a broken world. And Jesus calls us to walk in that with him. Be who you are where you are. I think a lot of pastors have a dream that matches the life of some pastor somewhere else. You know, this is closely related to wanting, you know, a bride of Christ somewhere else. But there's a temptation for us to say, I wish I was him. I wish I had his gifts. I wish I had his voice, his preaching style, his stuff. I've just got lame old me. Don't you think, though, that if Jesus had wanted Tim Keller to pastor your church, he could surely go get him? Don't you think that? If Jesus had wanted Tim Keller or fill in the blank, whoever your idealized pastor is, the one that you listen to and you think, he's the bomb, he's who I should be, he's who I wish I spoke like, don't you think God could go get him? Be who you are where you are. God has called you to pastor that church. One of my favorite passages here that I would urge you to meditate on as men who pastor God's flock is this one from 1 Corinthians chapter 4, verses 3 through 4. This is one that actually keeps me sane on a regular basis. With me, it is a very small thing that I should be judged by you or any other human court. In fact, I do not even judge myself. I'm not aware of anything against myself, but I am not thereby acquitted. It is the Lord who judges. What is he saying there? He's like saying, you know what? My own self-assessment is sometimes off. I serve the living King of the universe. He is the one who's put me here. He is the one who calls me. I'm not going to second guess his decision. I'm not going to judge myself by dumb human standards, dumb comparisons, gift envy. Come on, I know it.
We do it. Jesus has called you to be pastor of that church. Sorry, I'm behind here a little bit. This is a tough season, but things will slow down. Man, Huber and I told each other this for the first 5.5 years of ministry at Liberty, and we've been going for 6, okay? So that is not true. It is never slows down. Stuff never slows down. Perry Noble, as a church planning kind of guru, he says that is a lie from hell. We want to all believe it. It is, look, the seasons of ministry will change. You're going to go from this, pre-launch. How are we going to structure a worship ministry from the ground up? Then you're going to say, how are we going to run a worship ministry? How are we going to staff this? Then you're going to say, how are we going to manage this worship guy? And then you're going to say, how are we going to fire that guy who's driving us crazy and drawing the church away from Christ? See, it doesn't change. The complexities, you know, the sense of pacing, the sense of intensity, it's not going anywhere. There's no glory time where you're going to reach when everything's going to be magical and golden. You're going to go from one set of complexities to another. And so I think that when we say this kind of thing, hey, this is a tough season, but it'll slow down soon. What we're really doing is it's a coping strategy. It's a coping strategy. We're saying life is hard and I need Sabbath. I need rest. So the real question is not, how am I going to get past this season? It's how am I going to find Sabbath? Where am I going to have my soul refueled? How am I having Jesus pour back into me what is feeling like it's being drained out all the time? You know, you've got to find ways. You've got to fight for ways to find Sabbath in ministry, because it's not going to be delivered. No UPS guy brings that in a box on Monday mornings. It doesn't come with a day off. Sabbath is something that, gentlemen, we have to learn to fight for. We have to learn to work on in our ministry. Layering, a death to perfectionism. You know, to survive in ministry, you have to have a certain amount of Larry the Cable Guy in your blood. Yes, Larry the Cable Guy. Get her done, okay? This is not pragmatism. This is ministry, okay? You don't have time to read 5 books on small groups, attend 2 conferences, write a position paper, and then launch it 2 years from now. Sorry. This is how it works, gentlemen. You start it off and you hope the first year it maybe is a C-. The next year, you maybe do B-. If you're lucky, you might get up to B+. But you keep trying. It's a concept called layering. And it's not just pragmatism, it's called ministry. Layering is how Wikipedia actually got started. What they did was they wrote, 1,000 mediocre articles. They put them out on the web. They made it open source. And they allowed people to kind of improve upon it. And they eventually got some really awesome millions of really well-written articles, right? But it's by allowing it to be layered, layer upon layer. You know, let's do this better next season. We're going to work on this. We're going to, we learn some things. We're going to innovate. We're going to try something new. We'll build on what we learned. It's a death, though, to perfectionism. Get her done. So, hey, a couple more things. Not managing your church, but leading it. I actually lost the last part of that. Not managing your church, but leading it. Hold tightly to your models, to your mission, loosely to your model. You know, if you can hold on as firmly as possible to what you believe God has called you to do, but be open-handed with the other hand on the strategies about that, that is a key to survival. You know, it wasn't like 2 years ago that me and Steve Huber were speaking on multi-site ministry at an Acts 29 regional gathering at the same time that we were flushing our model on multi-site ministry and redoing it. I mean, I felt like such a hypocrite, but we were like, honestly, we have to really rethink this. We have to rethink our model. We spent a lot of elders meetings, a lot of gathering time, a lot of sweat saying, how are we going to, we had this model, Parts of it are working, parts of it aren't. How are we going to be willing to tweak it? What are we going to do with this? You know, who cares? Who cares that you have to change your model some? Hold on to your mission. You know, don't act like, you know, your model, your strategy for ministry is not baptized. You're not like John on the Isle of Patmos receiving this straight down from the Holy Spirit. So don't act like it. Be willing to say, God, you're changing the rules of the game. This neighborhood is not exactly what I thought it was coming in. And I need to not be so stubborn. I need to be willing to innovate things. More briefly, do a few things well. A few things well. My favorite cart in Center City, Philadelphia, is this guy, 20th and Market, who makes falafel. And you go to the guy's cart, and he is an incredible falafel. I mean, it's an incredible experience. You get the pita with beet-infused risotto. You get falafel. You get grilled chicken that's done right there. I mean, the smoke coming off of his grill, you can smell it all around. And the garlic is unbelievable. But he only makes one thing. He makes falafel. People come to the cart, and he's like the soup Nazi on Seinfeld, and they're like, hey, can I have that without risotto? And he's like, get out of here! You know, I don't want to see you again. He won't change it. He won't. You get it one way, or you're out. He's not a great businessman, but he really knows one thing, and he knows how to do one thing well, and he sticks with it. And we could actually learn a little bit about that in church planting. I read guys like vision write-ups, and it sounds like this. I'm going to have excellent preaching, mercy ministries, family-friendly, neighborhood-centric, reclaiming the arts, racial reconciliation, organic, apologetics-focused, social justice, international missions, reform theology powerhouse, community development, write your own worship music. And I'm like, you got to be kidding me. Like, either you got Red Bull running through your veins, or, you know, or you're like my lunatic cart guy. Like, you're crazy. Do a couple things well. You know, we actually should really learn, like, simplifying ministry. Sticking with a few things and doing them well. You have to decide what you're going to major on. Decide comes from the same root word as pesticide. It means you have to kill off some things. You have to kill off alternative views and perfect churches that you can't plant. All those things that you wish you could do, that you cannot do. Doing a few things and doing them very, very well. Knowing what you're going to die for, what is essential and what is gravy? What's icing? What's like, hey, if it comes along, that's great, but you know, this isn't what Jesus has said this church is going to be about. Okay. Make it a habit of disappointing people. I think this is really important. Make it a habit to disappoint people. People need Jesus. They don't need you. You need to do this in two ways. One is you need to fail every once in a while. You need to try some things that honestly flop. And have the guts to be willing to try some things that you like, I think this could work, and you fail, and therefore your staff people, your ministry leaders have permission to know, like, we can try stuff here. And not everything has to be golden every time. It can fail on the way out. The second way you need to disappoint people is that they need to be able to say, you know, this person is a human being. One of my struggles in ministry, one of my real struggles is I get confused about what I'm supposed to be doing. Sometimes I think my calling is to be a good pastor. I mean, isn't that what everybody's telling you? Everybody in your church wants you to be a good pastor. But that's not what Jesus has called us to. Jesus has called me to love and obey him. To love and obey him. You know, when you get mixed up on that, you try to please everybody. You try to incarnate yourself into every, like, shapeshifter version of what a pastor's supposed to be, and it ends up killing you. You find yourself divided. You find yourself all over the map. God has called you to love and obey him. To love and obey him, and it's okay to disappoint them. In fact, it's part of their sanctification. Because they're like, you know what? I'm not going to put my hope in that guy. That guy's not going to always be here for me. Jesus will. You're not called to be the middle manager of the kingdom of God. One of the things I've noticed that I think is going on right now in our culture is that there is a lot of things that are, there's a confusion of management with leadership. You know, management's an important thing. We need ministries that run effectively, but management is not the same thing as leadership. Leadership has got to be driven by calling. It's by driven by calling, driven by vision. It's never called, it's never a calling to a position, but calling to a mission. And a leader is one who knows how to call people to something and when to get out of the way. God has not called us to manage, to kind of just kind of keep the stuff floating, to keep things going. He's called us to lead. So closely related to this, well, let me just say this. If you are not, if you are managing, then you're hitting maintenance. One of our mentors in ministry used to say, risk or rust, boys. Risk or rust. Closely related to this is this. The enemy of innovation is success. If you've done something well, you're your worst enemy because you don't want to change it. You don't want to make it different for the future. It's once you've got something good, you want to rubber stamp it instead of recreate it. And one of the challenges of that is that you can easily get on the decline and not even know it. Because you're like, this has worked. It's worked okay. It's worked before. Fourth, four out of five here. Managing to find good partners and empower them. I'm not going to talk today about developing elders. That's really an entire other talk that we ought to probably have as a unit in one of our A29 gatherings. I want to talk more generally about leaders in your church, including elders and staff and key ministry leaders. And I'm not going to talk necessarily about developing disciples either. That's also another subject. But let me talk about developing, managing to find good partners and empower them. Number one, your mom isn't available. Most guys want mom to help them out in ministry. You know, let's be honest. If about 20% of the things that you're doing are things that you hate to do, that you're actually pretty well suited to where you are. That's for any job, anywhere. That's just practical business wisdom. If there's about 20% of your job that you're like, yeah, this kind of sucks, but I got to do it, you're actually doing pretty well. You're pretty well fit. Most guys want to hire staff so that number can be zero, and that's incredibly unrealistic. You know, so we want mom to come along. We don't want ministry partners. We want our mom to come and like fix stuff for us and make things better. We want to hire support staff that are going to kind of make take away our headaches. Therefore, we're looking for mom, not admin. We're looking for a butler, not a worship guy. You know, executive pastor, you know, you want to talk about some of Phil's headaches is, you know, people looking for an executive pastor who are really looking for, you know, a butler. We're looking for ministry partners. And I want to encourage you. Everybody's like, staff to your weakness, staff to your weakness. I'm so sick of hearing about staffing to your weakness. Because what people really mean is, I don't want to deal with junk in ministry. I'd like somebody else to do that. And so that's my weakness, and I'm going to find somebody to do that. My experience is that most pastors have zero managerial experience and think it's going to be no big deal. When it really requires a ton of work to manage other people well. It requires a ton. If you've had to do that in a job, you know that that can be your biggest headache. My word to you is this. Hey, bozo, a large staff means that that's what you're doing for your job. I went out and visited a friend at a large church in another city that was my altar dream. You know, he's got like the gorgeous building, the huge staff that is doing ministry. And, you know, I had idealized in some ways this guy's position. I go out and hang out with him for a couple days and realize how much his life sucks. Because I was like, you got all these staff and that's who you get to spend time with. And your church thinks that staff do ministry rather than people doing ministry. Man, that sucks. It was great perspective for me to remind me, you know what? Be careful what you wish for. You know, we idealize stuff like that, and we think that staffing is going to resolve issues instead of creating more. Be careful. Therefore, you should steal a philosophy of staffing from somebody else. I bet that most of you, when you were thinking about planning a church, you weren't dreaming about this. Hey, I wonder how much we should pay people who are working support positions in our church. What do we call full-time and part-time? Who do we give benefits to? Most of you, when you're fantasizing about starting a church, you're not fantasizing about writing a policy and procedures manual for human resources, are you? No, most of us have zero experience of this, and I would encourage you to steal something from someone else, okay? Break into the church office of the church near you, go in the Mission Impossible theme song playing in the background, and steal it out of their filing cabinets. Because you don't need to worry about coming up with this stuff. You need to borrow this from somebody who's, you know, made this up before. Why do churches have policy and procedure manuals? Because they've had bad problems. They've born out of mistakes. So learn from somebody else's mistakes, steal it, bring it in, and use it. Enough said. Find someone who can keep an eye on the back end of the store. I was every day I go downtown to my office, I pass right through Benjamin Franklin Parkway. And we've had a lot of police shootings this year. And when there's a police shooting, there's a huge gathering a couple days later for the funeral right down the parkway. And there'll be like 1,000 police cars. And I'm riding down to work a couple weeks ago, and I hear somebody say, man, I wonder who's minding the store while all the police are down here. And it got me thinking. I'm like, yeah, you know what? One of the things that we need to think about is finding someone that's not you in ministry to mind the back end of the store, the business side of the church. Most pastors that I've met or church planners don't even know how to read an income versus an expense sheet, right? Do you know, how many of you, raise your hands if you know what accrual-based accounting really means and can define it in a sentence? Wow. Okay, one. There we go. Most of us know jack something else about accounting. Okay? And so I would encourage you to find someone else to give that headache to. Enough said. Empower your people to make decisions. One of the problems in ministry is creating a bottleneck for decision-making. If you can figure out ways to empower people to make decisions, in other words, you tell the leader, you give it to somebody you entrust, and you walk out of the room when they have the meeting. You remove your presence. Most guys, unfortunately, are so married to their vision that they want to micromanage it, and they end up creating a bottleneck for decision making. If you can teach your people how to make decisions and give them a grid to do so they're empowered to do it without you having to be on the cell phone, on the email, or right in the room, the better. The more you can multiply your effectiveness in ministry. Here's some key questions filters to figure out how you can, to give people, say, here's how you can figure out what's the right answer to this thing. Does the decision compromise the gospel? Will it negatively impact our mission? Is this something everyone will be genuinely excited about? Is it a temporary solution? Will this decision add more to our plate? Are we attempting excellence or extravagance? Is it extra? Am I making this decision for the good of the church or just for me and my reputation? If you can get people to think along those lines, they can be empowered to make decisions without you in the room. A couple things real briefly, and I'll be done. Develop leaders and know their wives. I think this is incredibly important with elders. One of the things that we saw within our team early on is that our wives didn't have access to one another on a regular basis. If they don't have access, they have no room to build trust. If you know a man's wife, if she trusts you as an elder, if she's like, hey, I know that pastor cares about my husband, knows what's going on in my home life, and prays for us, you have got that man in your pocket as an elder. He is going to back you up. He's going to be on your page. You know, the degree to which, think about this. Who has more influence on that guy? You preach to him, she sleeps with him. You know, knowing guys' wives, having regular interaction, where it's just, maybe it's just a party. Maybe just have people over your house, you know, every couple of months. But having some room for regular interaction where you actually look them in the face and talk to their wives and act like you care about them. That's really important. That really, really matters. Finally, this. Managed to have some fun. If I could go back 5 years and slap myself, this is what I would say to me. Remember some of you are my age or older and remember the Aqua Velva commercial from the 80s where they had a guy who shaves, and then they have somebody off the screen who slaps him across the face, and he says, "Thanks, I needed that." And, you know, if I could go back 5 years and dope slap myself, this is what I'd say. Lighten up. Lighten up. Enjoy this. Jesus has called you to one of the most exciting and fun things to do. And if you're not having fun doing ministry, there's probably something wrong. That may sound completely naive, completely like giddy and Disney and joy-filled. You know, I just want to encourage you to not take yourself so stinking seriously. You know, Jesus is Lord of His church. He's called us to a life of joyful worship with Him. And if I could offer you one thing today, is it would be enjoy this. Have fun doing this. This is a fun, crazy, break your heart, make your day ride planting churches. Enjoy it.